One creature. Caught. Caught in a place he cannot stir from in the dark. Alone. Outnumbered hundreds to one. Nothing to live for but his memories. Nothing to live with but his gadgets, his cars, his guns, gimmicks. And yet the whole family can't bring him down out of that. That.
Hunky paradise, brother.
Forget the old ways, brother. All the old hatreds, all the old pains. Forget. And remember, the family is one.
Welcome to Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me, as always, to the left is Jason.
Hey, everybody. Yes, it's true. I do dress to the left.
And we're talking today about the future, and not specifically a bright one, but an anomaly that really seemed to happen when we were kids, and that was the apocalypse movie.
Yes.
The future was kind of dreary and upsetting. Science fiction, until basically Lucas came back with Star Wars, sci-fi was pretty much an unhappy place. And, you know, I think being a kid of the 70s and watching a ton of TV like I did, I saw a lot of this stuff as a kid, and I was inundated with it. I don't know if you're the same, Jason.
Well, you know, it's funny you because we usually have these little two-minute rehearsals before we start recording to talk about a bit of this stuff, but
you mean 2 hour show prep sessions?
Yeah. 2 hour show prep for an hour and 10 minute show.
Yep.
It's funny that you say that because, you know, what is the there was a trend. There did seem to be a trend late '60s, but early to mid '70s, trend of, you know, the lone man or the apocalypse. I mean, actually right up until the early '80s. And it struck me just talking about it, just the past, you know, few minutes or whatever, that is that, when you think about that kind of paranoia, that kind of bleak outlook and stuff that just scares your socks off as a kid, I think we had it during the Cold War.
Oh, and absolutely.
Then it kind of went away a little bit, and then it had this resurgence in the early 70s. And do you think that that had something to do with the political climate? You know, obviously you're in Canada, but I mean, where a lot of this stuff was being made in the U.S., do you think it had to do with that mid-70s, All the President's Men, you know, paranoia and, you know, Vietnam and feeling helpless and all that? Because there really wasn't, I mean, there wasn't a lot of talk of the superpowers in the mid-70s and the finger on the button kind of thing. So that wasn't until like the early, you know, 80s, but where do you think that trend started or came from?
I think you hit the nail on the head. You've got, you know, the 60s really didn't go anywhere. You know, mm-hmm. We had all this pushing for change, and I think there was a disillusionment in a lot of the movements. You had, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy getting assassinated. You had this new fear of environmentalism that really started to come up in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You had, of course, the ever-present Cold War. You had a war that never ends. And just kind of maybe a disenfranchisement with the world. Because there's just something about a lot of the films at that time. They're kind of dreary. Well, also, take into consideration a movie like Easy Rider.
Uh-huh.
Where it turned Hollywood on its ear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a downer film.
Wouldn't you also say, because I just go back to what you said 2 seconds ago, environmentally, wasn't there more of an awareness about, was it? I mean, that to me is where it kind of started. 60s, you know, they always say it's the old cliche, like the 60s really didn't end until like 72.
Yeah.
You know, the 60s didn't really start until like 64. You know, the environmental stuff was touched on with the hippie movement and everything else in the 60s, but really, wasn't it, wouldn't you say that it was to like the early to mid 70s where people started to really kind of be aware of just how shitty things were looking and turning out with pollution and the gas crisis and all that?
Oh, absolutely.
Where it was that nototion of, you know, something could go horribly wrong and, you know, let's start building
bombs. You had TV movies scaring you about it. I mean, Doctor Who had a 6-part serial called The Green Death, which was about chemical companies poisoning the earth.
Giant maggots.
You had Godzilla fighting the smog monster.
Yeah,
you had Spectre Man. You
did he get smog checks, the smog monster?
I don't know. You know, I've never seen that Godzilla movie.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah, and you had covers of Superman fighting pollution, and you know, it was very relevant in the early 70s. So the best way sometimes to portray a message you're trying to get out there is to go with the extreme and an allegory, like, you know, some of the films we're going to talk about tonight, or this morning, depending on when you're listening. I think the grand, you know, you touched upon a thing, and in the 50s we had this atomic scare, and you did have movies like Panic in the Year Zero, or The World, the Flesh and the Devil, or some of the Roger Corman silliness. But
what was the one that I always think of? Sorry, but Cold War ish, but it's futuristic. Remember On the Beach?
Did of you course, ever see? Yeah, that's a classic. Yeah.
Gregory Peck and Fred Astaire, I think.
Yep.
Was that post something, or was it?
I believe it was post-apocalyptic. Yes.
Post-apocalyptic.
They all want to go to Australia, as I recall.
That's right.
Very, very good film.
Yeah. Great.
But I think that was all old hat by the late 60s. I mean, Larry Buchanan was remaking some Roger Corman. I think he remade The Day the World Ended on TV at that time. It's called In the Year 2525. Seek it out. It's terrible.
Great song.
Yes. Has nothing to do with this movie.
Zager and Evans?
But the I think the one that started the whole trend of the downer post-apocalyptic movie for our generation has to be Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
More importantly, the original Planet of the Apes, you know, the big shocker twist ending, and we'll do a whole Planet of the Apes show, so if we're a little light on this, it's because we're saving it. Then, of course, beneath the Planet of the Apes was, you know, even a bigger downer ending because everybody died.
Well, you know what's funny
a spoiler.
What's funny about the first, yeah, in case you haven't seen any of the Apes films.
How many times have we used that joke?
What the funny thing about the first Apes, though, and I would stand by this. Maybe I'm wrong in this assumption, but I think most people that look back at that first movie, I'm not sure they immediately go to the post-apocalyptic thing. Do you know what I mean? I mean you and I would, but you're sort of you know, surface knowledge, like, oh, I love the Apes. You know, how many people do you think really grab onto it as this post-apocalyptic thing, or that, you know, something went horribly wrong and the Apes took over? Or, you know, I think most people don't even know why the Apes, because you really have to sift through all five movies or six movies to figure out how they got there in the first place. But,
yeah, but
do you think people associate it with an apocalyptic thing?
I do.
You do?
Because
well, you're
this
wrong.
Is the anomaly. This is the anomaly that I wanted to discuss too, and it's something that you wouldn't. I had a playset as a child, or that was a burned out building in an abandoned city from Planet of the Apes, the Forbidden Zone trap by Mego, and that is a post apocalyptic playset, and that's a weird thing.
Yeah.
To think you would give a kid, here's a nuclear irradiated city, son. Enjoy.
Have fun. Sleep well.
Yep. You know, but we also had, like, Remco made the Earthquake Tower playset, which simulated a building collapse.
Was that tied into the movie?
Yes, it absolutely was.
Wasn't there one, just total side note, wasn't there a mid-70s... not a monster movie, but it was something about a car that goes berserk called The Car or something.
Yeah, that's James Brolin.
James Brolin.
Yeah.
And didn't you say that there was a tie-in game?
Kenner tried to propose a game that did not go through for obvious reasons.
Because it was a car.
But, you know, hitting people. you know, the Jaws game obviously inspired some
classic game,
some Me Too people, and I think the car game, and I believe Ideal also made a game based on the movie Alligator.
Yes, they did. Yeah. They did, which no kid saw. That was an R. That was a hard R. Total side note again, Jaws game. I probably played that game maybe 5 or 6 times, but the other 1,700 times I played with the shark, I just played with the shark.
Oh yeah, he would attack the Super Friends. He would show up on Star Trek. Yeah, absolutely.
He was an okay game.
He could fit like 7 Migos in there too.
He was a fine adversary. Yeah. But he was a mediocre board game, but a fine, fine adversary.
Yeah, I got bored of it too. So you know, I think Apes and particularly Beneath the Planet of the Apes started this trend for American cinema. You know, we can talk about around the world, but it also seemed to make Charlton Heston the face of post-apocalyptic cinema.
Yes, he was. But can I just go back for a second, if I may?
Okay.
Because, you know, we can do whatever we want in this show.
There's no moderator.
We make the rules.
That's right.
Because this will tie into Apes. The other thing that I associate this post-apocalyptic thing, and it's nothing to do with the time frame. It's more to do with the themes. Overall, I make a huge association with the Twilight Zone.
Oh, yeah.
And Serling, you know, Serling being a man, you know, that came out of war, and being very anti-war and very anti-nuclear weapons and everything. And it's certainly the time frame, early 60s for Twilight Zone. Mm. There was a good chunk of those episodes, you know, a good, I don't know, dozen or so, whatever, that had to do with impending apocalypse or post-apocalypse, or they think it's the apocalypse but they land someplace else, or it didn't happen or something.
Those are some of my favorites, actually.
And it's ironic that, you know, it's funny, we were talking about Apes, the new issue, and I don't know if you ever knew this, I'm just grabbing it now as we're talking in my my underground bunker. I have an underground bunker very similar to where Lex Luthor hung out in the first Superman, and just a wall of.
I opened the door for Valerie Perrine recently. I could probably get her to come over.
Metaphorically or physically?
Opened the door for Valerie Perrine.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a horrible Comic-Con she was trying to get in.
Oh, bless her heart.
Yeah.
She seems like she'd be a nice lady.
She looks like a very nice lady.
I think we could probably be friends. So this new issue of Empire Magazine, okay, it's the 301 greatest movies of all time. And, you know, take it with a grain of salt because these things come out every couple of years. But this was a poll of like 300,000 people on the World Wide Web.
What's that?
Guess what number 2 was?
Battlefield Earth.
Battlefield Earth. You're right. No, it's The Godfather. Guess what number 1 is? I'm stalling because I'm looking for this article.
Okay, I'm gonna go with my original answer.
You've been rooting for Battlefield Earth for a long time.
God help me, I love Battlefield Earth, but that's a whole episode.
I have the Travolta action figure. I have the small action figure.
I'm sorry. Comes with
a pile of golds.
Yeah.
It is The Empire Strikes Back. Anyway, I'm looking for it, but I can't find it. Somewhere in here, Planet of the Apes. And there's an article about the ending. Literally, this entire 4-page article on Apes is just about the ending. And I wish I could find it because I'll give you the name of the person. Apparently, there was a dispute somewhere that got started that was for a time in the 70s. This is pre-internet and pre, you know, hit Google and look it up, that was disputing whether Serling came up with that ending.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that before. It certainly does. I've always kind of thought it made sense.
Serling's quote himself told Cinefantastique's Dale Wynne Ogura in 1972, his quote, this is so Serling, this is his quote, "Yeah, I always believed that was my idea." someone was trying to take credit for it, but then I think Blake Edwards of all people jumped out and said that was Serling's idea, you know, through and through. And it really, we talked about this before when we talked about Serling, it is one of the most significant things about the film, changes everything, And I certainly changed the source material, and, you know, it's just a shiver down the spine of, you know, mm-hmm. for nightmares, you know, for kids and all that stuff. So it would make sense that Serling would do what he did with Twilight Zone in certain episodes, have that paranoia, and then it really comes to a head in the best way possible.
And it really kicked off the Aiden franchise to end terribly each time. There's no happy endings in those.
No, and when you've got a punch like that, sorry, I'm so sorry. Can you pause? Bowie! Sorry.
Can't pause, but I will...
Yeah, would you please? Because I don't want
to... Yeah, I'll cut that out of there. All right.
But when you have an ending like that, you're constantly trying to come up with something that's going to be nearly as spine-chilling or as poignant. But continue, please. Go ahead.
Yeah, so after the apes, it starts to really trickle out. And actually, I'm just going to... You haven't probably seen this film. But one of the earliest ones I could find is a film called Idaho Transfer.
I have not seen that.
It is directed by Peter Fonda.
Okay.
And it is his follow-up to Easy Rider.
Okay.
And it is a low-budget film about a group of people who are trying to transmat into the future.
And so it's a true story.
It's a true story. It was actually directed in 73. It's basically a lost film, but I can always find it in a dump bin on one of those compilations that says, you know, sci-fi classics.
Okay.
It's got Keith Carradine in it. It is a depressing as hell low-budget film.
Okay.
And, of course, it ends miserably. But it is a really neat film to watch, and it really is a product of its time. But I'd say the next big studio film to watch, and it's one of my personal favorites of all time, is The Omega Man.
Now, interesting thing about Omega Man, this would have been the second. So the first adaptation...
The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price.
Vincent Price, The Last Man on Earth, and famously written by...
Twilight Zone alum Richard Matheson.
Nipsey Russell.
Yes, Nipsey Russell. No, I believe the third version.
Yes.
What is interesting about this? It's one of my favorite books, too. It is a near classic book. Seek it out. Mm. It inspired Stephen King. It inspired George R. Romero to create Night of the Living Dead.
I didn't know that.
Yes. I just watched a documentary on Romero where he spells that out. It is in its purest form, and the Vincent Price version is far more faithful to the book.
I don't know the last time you've seen it, but I saw it a couple years ago. It popped up on Turner Classic or something. It's a good movie.
Except that Price is all wrong. I've always said that I would prefer to see Heston in The Last Man on Earth.
Yeah, you don't want to see, you know, you don't want to see Vincent Price as a mountain climber or working on a building site. You don't want to see Vincent Price doing anything but, you know, wearing a smoking jacket, you know, giving restaurant reviews or.
I love Price. I think Price is a treasure, but he is all wrong for that kind of. Robert Neville is a much more difficult character than. And he's very much, I think, a heck of a lot more masculine and not. But Price was an elegant gentleman. And,
yes, he was.
And he just doesn't pull it off, in my opinion. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's other. I'm sure I'll get an angry email
from Price's widow. Do you have the Vincent Price Shrunken Heads game thing?
No, I don't.
You need to get that.
Looking around this. This hoarding hovel of mine, I don't need to get anything except a broom.
But back to that. Heston slowly starts to become the face of sci-fi for a bit. He's kind of like a proto Harrison Ford kind of in genre pictures.
Yeah, I would. And so they take this book about a suburban man trapped in his own nightmare. All his neighbors are the vampires, and they turn Heston.
Clarence Williams III, is he the lead vampire?
No, he's not. That is not Clarence Williams III. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, who's the guy?
His name is it's the Lincoln Kilpatrick.
Lincoln Kilpatrick.
He's the guy who says my favorite line, which is "Honky Paradise, brother," which doesn't date the film at all.
No.
No.
No, it could have been yesterday.
Yeah. And what they did is instead of making them vampires, they're kind of a mutant Manson family, which I think was written because it was very fresh in the public's mind.
Right.
That they, you know, the vampires in the I'm going to spoil the original ending of the book. Turn this
All
off
right.
for
I'll
one minute
away.
If you haven't read it. What it is that the world is filled with vampires, and during the day, Neville is staking them. Wherever he finds them sleeping, he's staking them.
Mm-hmm.
What he comes to discover is there's actually a third race that is half human, half vampire. Mm. And he is their monster. They are afraid of him. And he realizes there are no more people left. They're killing all the vampires off. He's a monster, and he takes himself out. And so that's an unfilmable ending in Hollywood.
Yeah, you know,
he's always got to die heroically.
I was going to say, spoilers be damned. We does he die in Omega Man? I forget.
Yes, he does.
And
but
he dies
saving children, and Rosalind Cash and Paul Coslow from the you know, he's got the cure, and he saves the family.
Or Matthias
from the family, who's played by the great Anthony Zerbe, also played the villain in Hawaii 5-0, and he was the bad guy in Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park.
And wasn't he in Logan's Run?
No, he wasn't in Logan's Run. I think he was one of the Matrix films. Like, he's still kicking.
Yes, yes. He was also in License to Kill.
Yeah, and he was in one of the terrible Star Trek The Next Generation films. I can't remember which one.
Yes, you're right.
The one I wanted my $8 back.
Such a great name, though. It's just one of those great...
Zerbe.
And we need more Anthony Zerbes.
And a really good screen presence. The film is directed by Boris Segal, who's Katie Segal's dad. He's a bit of a TV journeyman. He died, actually, ironically, to this episode, he died filming the TV movie World War III.
That was a miniseries. I remember that. With David Roy Soul? Scheider? No, not Roy Scheider.
I thought David Soul.
David Soul. You're right.
How do you get Roy Scheider and David Soul mixed up?
Because Roy Scheider did do a movie that was like a World War III kind
of
movie.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to have to look this up. You make fun of me now, but it will all make sense someday.
Sure.
So
the Omega Man came out and it kind of went.
But see, that's the thing now. So we got Apes, but you know, the second one comes out in between Apes and Omega Man.
The third one came out in between Apes and
Omega. Okay, so second one had been out. So we've already seen him die.
Yep.
In second Apes, we've seen him die in Omega Man,
yep.
And then you get – when does Soylent Green rear its
I think
head?
Soylent Green is about 73, and I remember there is a book out there. It's in my local library. It's quite old, but it was Charlton Heston's like diary from around this period, so I read it. And you haven't lived until you've read like Charlton Heston going, "I cut the last reel of Deep Throat last night. I don't care for this." You know. He writes about the Omega Man in his diary, and he's all gung-ho.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time he's making Soylent Green, he's like, "This should do better than that hunk of crap I made called the Omega Man." Like, he's so down on it.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting thing here, that this trend of the hero either dying or getting, hauled off in it.
Does Heston die? Now, Soylent Green.
He doesn't die in Soylent Green, but... He looks like he's going to die. Someone's going to eat him very soon.
Soylent Green is one of my favorite post-apocalyptic movies.
But see, don't you feel like once
interesting choices?
But don't you feel like once you know? I mean, it's obviously a joke. Remember how Phil Hartman used to do it?
It's people. Yeah, and in fact, my Charlton Heston impersonation is an impersonation of Phil Hartman doing.
Yeah, Phil Hartman used to. Remember he did the Madonna sex book, and he said.
Yeah.
I like my vagina.
I don't care for that word.
Sometimes I look at you in the mirror.
Yes.
But the trend of the hero, you know, not making it out. That is a very 70s thing.
Yep.
It's a very early 70s. You know, we might.
And
not...
that's why I mentioned Easy Rider, because Easy Rider kind of kicked that off.
There's a great Warren Beatty film, because I love
Bonnie and Clyde too, right?
Well, oh, Bonnie, absolutely. Yeah. That's a downer of any. But there's a great, you know, because we were talking about Captain America, the Winter Soldier. One of the templates they were using for this was because we couldn't do a Cap in the mid-70s. What was interesting about Cap in the mid-70s with Falcon was very street. Cap was this straight-laced guy wondering, how did America get like this? I've been frozen for a bit. What's going on? Vietnam, Watergate, all that stuff. Mm. But we couldn't do that because you couldn't do a period thing. We already did the World War II thing. So the idea with WikiLeaks and, what's his name in China, Russia, whatever. Let's do something similar. And he's a man out of time with all this shit going on. The templates they used were all the president's men, 3 days of the Condor, and a great early 70s paranoia kind of thriller called The Parallax View.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Warren Beatty and Shecky Green.
Green and Charlie Gallis.
And Charlie Gallis. and I forget who the... But it's directed by Alan J. Pakula, who did Clute and All the President's Men and Beaches. I don't know. Anyway, but it's great because, well, I don't want to say much about it, but you just, as you're watching it, you just don't, you know, that early 70s, mid 70s thing, you weren't sure if your lead was going to make it out of this thing alive. And it's a very downer thing. I don't think you could do that today. If Johnny Depp started making movies and people noticed, like, the last three pictures he made, you know, he's the hero, but he gets killed at the end or, you know, whatever. I think that's kind of box office poison today. Yet didn't all these films do well that we just mentioned?
I think The Omega Man was a bit of a disappointment, but Soylent Green was a big hit. In fact, and this is kind of a funny story. My folks didn't go to the movies a lot, but I heard about these forever because my mother completely swore off science fiction. The two nights I know they did get a sitter and go to the movies, the first film they caught was Clockwork Orange. Which is really what I would like to see my Catholic-raised mother to watch.
Taking a break from going to the movies for a decade?
Yeah.
Here's what you should see.
And then the second one they saw that I know they saw was Soylent Green. So my mom thinks all science – like I remember when I tried to – you know, hey, Mom, there's a movie called Star Wars. She was like, no science fiction. None. You know,
she's been horribly scarred by two movies.
And my father – I remember my sister and my father arguing that Clockwork Orange – was science fiction at all. My dad did not think there was anything science fictional about that film.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tight argument.
Yeah, and actually, it's compelling to the movie.
Not particularly. But yeah. But don't you feel that you – I don't – well, back to Soylent Green, I think it's a great movie. I also think it's once you know the big twist – you're waiting for that shoe to drop the whole movie.
I like the whole look of the movie, too. I mean, it really is
And wasn't he? Was he a cop? Was he?
He's a cop, but like the world's falling apart so much that you don't quite get. Like I love. First of all, I love the clothing choices. Like everyone in the future gets neckerchiefs.
Yeah,
and then
also Edward G. Robinson last film.
Yep, he is. He's in the film and is actually one of the his characters is one of the whole keys to solving the puzzle.
Just FYI, for those of you that are playing at home, Lindsay did not go mental. There was a film in 1990 called The Fourth War, Cold War drama about two gung-ho border commanders, Roy Scheider and Jürgen Prochnow, who carry out their own private war against each other on the German-Czechoslovakia border. So
I'm going to edit that out.
Getting that mixed up with World War III. Back to the show.
I always get Laurence Olivier mixed up with Jackson Bostwick.
I don't know how, but it's possible.
Sorry, that's kind of mean to David Soul. So Soylent Green is probably one of the bigger downer apocalyptic movies.
Oh, yeah.
And then we have to go...
We haven't even told people what the ending is. We haven't even told... We're not going to.
No. But... Yeah, run out and see it yourself.
You know,
I do love that film though. I
four magical words.
Yeah,
words you'll never forget.
I just wonder if he's going to live at the end of that. And I like that. Also, Soylent Green has the weirdest opening sequence ever in a science fiction movie.
I don't think I remember it at all.
Oh yeah, you have to go back and see it. I'll post it if I can find it.
Okay.
Now, having said that, I think one of the films that we should really talk about, we'll flip over to the UK for a minute.
Please.
The UK made some batshit crazy end of the world movies.
Yes,
first one I can think of is called The Bed Sitting Room. It's more of a comedy. I think the reason I sought it out was Dudley Moore and Peter Cook have a part in it.
That's right.
It's almost beyond description. It's a really weird film.
It's insane. Now, this is after – they did a great one if you've never seen it because I know you're a fan of Cook and Moore and their stuff.
Yeah.
They did one – you ever see one called The Wrong Box?
No.
Michael Caine's a very little seen Michael Caine – mid-60s, Michael Caine, Peter Sellers has a small part, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, and someone like, you know, Susanna York or someone equally beautiful. And it's a comedy about the wrong coffin going to the wrong place or something.
Oh, okay.
I probably haven't seen that since VHS when I was in high school, and I don't know where you'd find it today, but it's a great movie. But anyway, so this was... What year was this one?
69. So it's really ahead of the curve. It's post-nuclear war London, and I think people start mutating into things. Like,
did they write it too?
I can't remember. And you know what? It's been so long since I've seen the film that I can't – you know, I wish I had found a copy of it. It was directed by Richard Lester.
Yes, that's why, because he did The Knack and How to Get It, and then, of course –
Superman.
Most famously, Hard Day's Night and Help.
Yeah.
And he worked with the Goons as well. But Richard Lester, that's why I know it.
Spike Milligan wrote it. It was a play.
Spike Milligan, of course, from the Goons. Yeah.
So it's okay. It's definitely – the next one I can think of from the UK is probably one of my favorites, and it is an acquired taste. Another movie that has an absolutely bizarre soundtrack, it's Ragtime. And it's based on the Michael Moorcock books, and it's called The Final Program or Last Days of Man on Earth. And it's directed by, who directed that? Robert Fust.
Looking it up right now.
Robert Fust.
All right.
And it stars John Finch.
John Finch.
And Robert Fust, of course, directed Dr. Fives and Dr. Fives Rises Again and the infamous Devil's Reign.
John Finch was a bit of a heartthrob, John Finch.
Mm-hmm. This is a weird-ass movie, and it's very mod. It takes place in the future, the world is ending. And, there's all kinds of signs to the world is ending. It's also one of these films that – and this was very indicative of 1970s science fiction, especially this kind of science fiction, and the next film we talk about will even have this, where they really don't let you in on it. They don't explain anything. You have to figure it out for yourself.
I think it's the acid that people were taking.
Yeah, there's some scenes of Finch's companion in the film, who is bisexual, and she absorbs people, and it's not explained, at least not in the cuts I've seen.
Okay.
And at the end, the world is ending, and they need to create a super being, a hermaphrodite. And, of course, it ends up being her and Finch. And
spoilers.
I'm sorry, but I actually got it spoiled because it's right there in the Psychotronic Guide when I read the description of the film. Again, Ragtime soundtrack, very mod, very interesting.
I want to see this. I'm looking it up on Netflix. I don't even see it. I'm going to look it up as The Final Program.
You have to spell program weird, like the UK version.
UK program. Yeah. That sounds like
you'd love it. It's right up your alley. And it's bizarre. I've seen it a couple of times. I actually really like it. The poster is just bizarre. And
hey, it's here. Final Program.
The future is canceled.
Well, you know what? It's not available.
Oh.
Yeah,
it's probably not on Canadian Netflix either, if that makes you feel better.
Yeah, it's not available. I'm going to have to do some digging, maybe on eBay or something, and find this. Yeah. Now, let's go back here to a theme here. So far, these are downers, but they're visually, you know, striking maybe, or there's some
very trippy.
Trippy, some weirdness. So far, these are you know, they're spooky, and they're kind of allegorical, or they're kind of saying, hey, you know, don't, but we're not seeing anything that's quite, you know, documentary style, like this could happen tomorrow just yet. Now, at the same time, something. Now, this may not qualify as a post-apocalyptic thing, but I want to talk about it for two reasons. One, because there was a time about a year ago that I texted you.
Yeah.
Just like you've got like Wikipedia in your frickin' brain for this stuff. I texted you just the surface plot of this thing I thought was a TV movie. It had occurred to me one day, I think I know. Hey, do you know about this TV? I think it's a TV movie, and I think it's Peter Graves, and it's spooky. And within 4 seconds, you texted back, yeah, it's called Where Have All the People Gone?
Yeah.
And I nearly dropped my phone like, that's it. This is one of a handful of things that I can point to. I mean, truly, I can only think of a handful from, you know, childhood, you know, 8, 9, 10, 7 years old, whatever it is, that truly gave me, you know, cold sweat.
Oh, really?
One of them I'll say, for example, and a lot of kids can say this, the commercial for Magic. Remember that
movie? Oh, yeah. No, I know. You're
with the freaking tummy.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, the last thing he says is something like, and then you are dead or something. It was like
that and the commercial for It's Alive were not my favorites as a kid.
When that thing would come on, I would have to leave the room if I was like staying overnight at my cousin's, and he would turn the volume up and try to drag me into the room, and I would scream because it would nightmare, that face, nightmare. This movie,
What was the name of that thing? Snaps? No, Fats.
Fats.
Yeah.
Yeah, that made it even weirder.
I don't even like looking at Anthony Hopkins.
Did you ever see a movie called Dead of Night?
Yeah, I think I have.
The one with the four stories in it?
Yeah.
That is spine-chilling. It's from the late 40s. Someday we'll talk about that freaking thing. And that,
you know, you say that about Where All the People Gone. I just want to point out that, like, I was terrified of all these movies. Beneath the Planet of the Apes gave me nightmares.
That was scary.
Mega Man gave me nightmares. Soylent Green gave me nightmares. I think that's why I like these.
Well, it's Where Have All the People Gone? Again, I don't even know much about it. I think it had something to do with solar flares. But the gist of it was, and this was the part that really gave me nightmares, when something would happen, or the thing would happen in a certain area, or the solar flare would hit a town, whatever the hell this was, the people would end up just being a pile of clothing on the floor. But it wasn't even that. It was, if it was like, you know, if they were at like a garage, you know, a repairman's garage, whatever, and the guy was wearing overalls, all you'd see on the ground were the overalls splayed out like a chalk outline.
Yeah.
And then where the head would be and where the feet and the hands would be was like this white powder coming out of the sleeves and the neck. And it just something, I mean, it wasn't even that graphic. There's no blood. There's no screaming, no nothing. Something about that image gave me nightmares.
Yeah, it's
right,
creepy.
Right around the same time, I remember one time, this is like vivid. I don't know, I'm 5, 6 years old. I wanted to wear my socks to bed one time.
Mm-hmm.
One of my older brothers said, you shouldn't do that. If you wear your socks to bed, your feet will fall off. I believed him. I didn't wear socks to bed until probably second year of college when I didn't wear socks to bed one night, and I woke up with feet, and I was okay. But he scared the shit out of me because, you know, that movie had just been on.
Well, you know rock, paper, scissors?
Sure.
My sister invented whole new categories, rain and sun, and just anything to win. And it probably took a year before I tried that on someone. Well, yeah, there's rain and sun, and it didn't end well. Older siblings can really mess with you.
That's funny. this sounds like, so that was, there's just something there for, again, Peter Graves. I think the daughter was blah, blah. What's her name?
Oh, yeah.
No, she was, you know her. She was, did you ever see that movie with Kurt Russell called Breakdown? Great movie. Best thing Kurt Russell's ever done. Husband and wife driving, they're going to move, they're moving town, they're driving through like Arizona and the car breaks down.
Oh, that's fairly,
kidnapped.
Yeah, that was a remake.
Was
it? Of a Dutch film?
Was it?
Yeah, I think so.
I didn't know. Well, she's the wife, and her name is Kathleen Quinlan. I think she plays the daughter.
Oh, yeah.
In Where Have All the People Gone?
She's the right age, yeah.
That was scary. Peter Graves was a made-for-TV movie. But right around the same time, mid-late 70s, comes along a sci-fi opus pre-Star Wars that ends up being one of little Brian Hyler's favorite things of all time.
Yes, it's Zardoz. No,
Zardoz. Oh, wait, we've got to hit Zardoz.
We should hit Zardoz before we get into the other one. Yeah, Zardoz is
mental. It's completely insane.
It has some, like, I've tried to watch that, especially in college. I'd watch it and rewatch it. It has some interesting thoughts.
Do you know how some movies,
but
like,
visually, it just, the visuals just lose you. Sean Connery running around in a diaper.
Do you know how some movies they miss the mark when they come out? 10 years later, they're suddenly appreciated.
Absolutely.
Five years after that, they're reassessed and people go, you know, it's got a lot of flaws. And then, you know, 5 years after that, people go back to it and go, but it's also got this. Zardoz is one of those things that, even if that script was perfect, even if there was nothing dated about it and you didn't snicker at anything, there is not enough work that could be done to erase the image of what Connery looks like in that movie.
No, and the idea of the, you know, the giant head floating around barfing out guns.
And saying things like the penis is bad or the gun is
good. Yeah, there's... You know, and it's weird. I don't know if you know this.
We've all used these lines.
DC Comics created a villain for Superman called Vartox that is based on Sean Connery in Zardoz. His costume isn't quite as, you know, onesie as... But yeah, he's in shorts and high boots. He's got a little vest and a big mustache.
Now, for those of you, again, that may not know what Zardoz is, this is early 70s. It's a John Borman film. It's definitely sci-fi. I won't go into the plot too much. But what it has is Sean Connery, who is literally like a year or two out of Bond. He'd come back for Diamonds Are Forever in 71, got his $1 million, vowed never to do it again, and... This is one of the next things that he does. And, you know, at the time, Connery wasn't known for, like, picking, you know, he tried doing the artistic thing. He did a great movie called The Offense, which is probably the best acting job he ever did. He executive produced it. It's Sidney Lumet. It's a brilliant movie. But nobody wanted to see that stuff. So he's clearly thinking about, you know, paycheck, you know, big budget things, whatever. Somebody steered him in the direction of Zardoz. And in this movie... He is wearing what can only be described as a giant red cloth diaper, two bullet, you know, bandoliers across his chest like the Frito Bandito.
And a pot, yeah.
He's carrying is it like a Luger?
It's like a revolver.
A revolver.
And he don't forget his braided ponytail.
Braided ponytail down to his ass.
Thigh high boots.
Giant 70s porn tash. Like, you know, right down the sides of the mouth. And best of all, do you remember the producers? Did you ever see the original producers with Zero Mostel?
Not in a long time, but yeah.
Well, Dick Shawn shows up as a guy called LSD. And he's wearing these – it's 1968. He's wearing these boots that are like pirate boots on acid. They go up past – you know what they are? They're like the boots in the mirror world – in Star Trek, the original Star Trek, right?
Okay.
So, you know, when they go in, when it's, you know, Spock with the goatee.
Yeah, I remember that one. I don't particularly remember the footwear of the Empire.
So in the real Star Trek world, they're wearing those little mini beetle boots that go up past the, you know, past the ankle or whatever. And in the mirror world, they go right up past the knee and they fan out into a big thing. That's what Connery's wearing throughout the he doesn't even just wear like in the first 10 minutes and then he's, you know, then he finds some, you know.
And the name Zardoz comes from Wizard of Oz, which is one of the big epiphanies in the movie, and it's the only thing I really, you know, that makes a lot of sense. But basically it's like two societies, the Brutals and this eternal race. And, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, it's definitely not one of – it's an interesting film. I recommend people watch it, but I don't know if it's anyone's favorite movie.
No. Although I will say the image of that floating head
– it's neat.
It's neat. It's kind of a striking image the first couple of minutes. Okay, so now Zardoz.
Let's round out the UK and then switch back to Logan's. The other film I wanted to just talk
– Logan's a – Wasn't Logan's a UK thing?
No, but that's just, there's just two UK leads, which, you know, I've already gone into that.
Right.
The last UK film that I can remember that I wanted to talk about was called No Blade of Grass.
It's another
environmental film. It's not that popular. It's end of the world. There's no food being produced. This man is trying to get his family out of London. It's a film directed by Cornel Wilde.
Okay.
Who you remember from The Naked Prey.
Yes.
And Wilde made some really interesting films after The Naked Prey, and none of them were as memorable, I find. But this is one of those things where, you know, he was making a sci-fi. He's a very heavy-handed guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this one's very heavy-handed. I saw it once on a black-and-white TV, so maybe I shouldn't comment too much. But another one of these, you know, in, the environment is dying, we're dying, downer-type films. So,
wow.
And so, society's breaking down.
It's not so much a there's not a lot of action going on in this one?
There is a lot of action going on.
Oh, there is? Okay.
Yeah, okay. They have to fight their way to Scotland. Scotland is somehow the Horn of Plenty in that film.
I can't say how many times I've had to do that.
Yeah, no, me too. Usually, I think you fight your way out of Scotland.
Yeah, trying to get out of Glasgow.
I can say that because I'm part Scottish.
Okay, so let's get to one of your favorite things, because I never tire of you talking about Logan's Run and your fascination with it, because it is, I mean, a lot of people, you know, really like Logan's Run. I think you're one of those people that loves Logan's Run. You love the TV series, you know, you've got collectibles, etc. So tell us about this run of Logan's you speak
of. Logan's Run is not necessarily originally an apocalyptic story. The book was written by William Nolan, and it was more or less, I think, a reaction to the youth movement in the late 60s. And they hammered this thing out, and basically the original plot of Logan's Run wasn't post-apocalyptic at all. It was a world where you got to live to be 21, and it was a paradise of a world. And the original book is probably unfilmable at the time because it really does take place all over the world. There's a huge population on the world, but you know, once you turn 21, you're to commit suicide or you're hunted down by the Sandman.
Carousel, right?
No, there's no carousel in the book.
Oh, there's no carousel in the
book. Carousel is invented. So I guess when they produced the film, and the, you know, it's funny because I like some of the book, but I love some of the changes the film made, especially the design choices and the aesthetics and that sort of thing. So I'm kind of torn between all different adaptations.
And the boobies.
Well, yes, that goes without saying. All these movies have a ton of nudity in them.
Yeah, and they're PG, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
what happened to those days?
Omega Man's got a nude scene in it. Zardoz is definitely, everyone's just hanging out.
Heston shows his ass in Apes.
Yep. I wasn't going to mention that one. Logan's Run, for the film, they decided to make it a post-apocalyptic environment. So it's a city, it's a contained unit. They changed the age from 21 to 30 so that they wouldn't all go to jail for showing teenagers getting naked. And then
Who's the director? Franklin?
No, the director is Michael Anderson, who directed the Doc Savage as well. So it's a flawed film, but it's a good film.
It's got great design.
It has beautiful design.
Great design work.
Right down to, like, you know, I know the city's a mall, but the costuming is fabulous. The weaponry, the idea of the weaponry is
guns are great.
Brilliant.
Do you have one of those guns?
Yes, I do.
You know how obsessed I am with you know, replicas.
Yep.
And either toy replicas or prop replicas of certain guns. Speaking of which, total side note, have you noticed, and this will date this show, Guardians of the Galaxy, the new movie that's coming out, the new Marvel thing. Have you noticed the guns that the lead character, Star-Lord, carries around? And this might be right out of the comic, I don't know.
I think the character does carry some sort of elemental gun. I am really unfamiliar with Star-Lord. The only issue of Star-Lord I ever bought was because there was a Tom Baker Doctor Who story in the back of it.
Oh.
Like Marvel just, we need 8 pages, and they shoved a Doctor Who Weekly story in there.
These the guns that the character carries around, pretty close to the black hole.
Oh.
It's like a double-barreled thing, and it made me think of the black hole, another toy that we never got. I'm sorry. So
no problem,
Logan's Run, weapons are great. cast, Jenny Agutter, Michael York, Farrah Fawcett Majors.
See, you know what? I really hate when people bring her up in that movie. She was the it girl in Hollywood. She may have done, you know, great work, but this is not
fantastic in that.
She's not good in this. like I said, she definitely proved her chops as an actress, but not in Logan's Run.
I'll tell you who's in it, who's my favorite person in it, and he died young, and it's a shame because I loved
Richard Jordan.
Richard Jordan.
Yeah.
That guy was great in everything he did, and he died very young. He died like in the mid-90s, I think.
Died in the mid-90s. In fact, I was told he died in a bathroom at a horror convention, which is weird, I know.
Jesus, what was he there for?
I was told, like, when I was in the bathroom at a horror convention, he had just died. He wasn't there. Sorry, that came out weird.
Sorry, I thought it was Patrick
Trump. It was also weird the second
thing. He died. What a horrible way to go.
He died after a battle of cancer.
Oh, I see. And what other things have you been told in bathrooms?
A lot, but I can't share them.
So Richard Jordan's and all these guys are in it. The effects are pretty good, too, right? They hold up pretty well.
They do for the most part. I mean, the city miniatures are a little silly now, but they were really needed.
Who's the robot?
Oh, Ross, your pal, Roscoe Lee Brown.
Roscoe Lee Brown.
And Peter Ustinov.
My man.
Dr. Snuggles himself, Peter Ustinov.
I always wondered why this robot was so anxious to get them naked and put them in furs when it's like 40 below zero.
Yeah, I can't. Box is actually in the book too, and he's much different in the book. He's much more of a cyborg, you know. I think it's supposed like he looks like a solid robot thanks to the film design, which is creepy, but in the book he's supposed to have like organic parts.
Okay.
And so I think that's why Box is kind of nuts. He's a humanoid, flawed, but it's another scene in these films, and you know I think it has one of those kind of moments like in Zardoz or in the final program where you don't know exactly what's going on. You're just accepting it, but you're going, why is there a robot freezing things here?
God, you know, it's funny you say that because I tried revisiting that not too long ago, like a year or two ago. It was on, and I think I immediately hit record. And boy, it reaches a point right around then when they're looking at books in the library with Ustinov and stuff where I suddenly just realize I have no idea what's going on in this story.
Yeah, it has a dazzling first act, an interesting middle act, and then the last act is a little tough. And then of course it spun off into the subsequent TV series, which I adore. And also, you know,
Gregory Harrison and
Randy Powell and Heather Menzies.
Yo, yeah, that's it. Heather Menzies. Yeah.
And Donald Moffat, who is...
Donald Moffat.
You know, the other three are novice actors, and Donald Moffat is just, you know, exuding character. He's got more gravitas than all three of them put together at this time, you know.
I'll tell you what's ironic, or maybe not. Maybe it's not that interesting, but it's just the kind of minutia that you and I obsess over for some stupid reason. Richard Jordan, one of the last roles he had in a movie was a White House big muckety-muck, you know, right next to the president in Hunt for Red October, Alec Baldwin as Jack Ryan. Donald Moffat ends up playing the president in Clear and Present Danger, Harrison Ford's second Jack Ryan picture.
Huh.
So there you go. A little bit of useless trivia that will never come up at a cocktail party, but feel free.
Standing next to Donald Moffat.
And you either want to talk about... Either want to talk about Tales of the City, Volume 1, or the connection between him and Richard Jordan.
I think the minute I got out the word Logan, he'd walk away from me.
Throw a drink in your face.
Yeah, I'll go.
So something interesting starts to happen now in the early 80s.
Well, I just wanted to...
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I just, you know, I didn't tell you about this since it's not in our comprehensive show guide. But not only did... you know, we did the Logan's Run TV series... But that's not the only post-apocalyptic. We had a Planet of the Apes television series.
Yes.
And Roddenberry, Mr. Happy Future,
yes,
tried three different attempts. Well, two, and then they stole his idea for the third one. Three different TV movies to get this kind of post-apocalyptic Star Trek off the ground. And they're called Genesis 2, Planet Earth, and then Strange New World, I think, is the third one.
Okay.
Seek those out. They're on Warner Archive. My personal favorite, because it really gets into formula, is Planet Earth, because it really is just Star Trek on a nuclear irradiated Earth. You know, John Saxon is the leader. He's Dylan Hunt. He's got a female number two. Then he's got Ted Cassidy as his kind of like not so much alien, maybe mutant sidekick. Then he's got another guy who's an Esper. You can see a lot of what became Star Trek the Next Generation in this. I really like it, and I wish it had made a series. I remember seeing that movie as a kid. The only thing that's kind of silly about it is the movie does center around like an Amazon female or matriarchal society that treats men as slaves, and they regrettably call the men dinks in the movie, which, you know, is hard to watch.
It's
after
wrong
all.
On so many levels.
It's so
that
funny.
Word shouldn't be unused in television. Hey, what was the? This wasn't post-apocalyptic, I don't think, but you'd know this. What was the British series where the women? It was like mid-70s, and there was a female race on a planet.
Oh, that's what is that called? Star Maidens.
I knew you would know.
There's Star Maidens action figures that are horrible, and I want
them. No.
Yes, they're god awful.
Show?
Yes. Yeah, they're like dollar store toys.
The show ran for like an episode. How is it possible that Star Maidens got
It ran for 13 episodes in England. That's 20 seasons.
And wasn't the lead the guy?
Gareth Thomas, yes.
Blake Seven?
Yes.
Before he put on a tummy?
Yeah, he's almost lead.
Just on the border. Wait, did you ever see a series he did called Children of the Stones?
No.
Great show. Spooky show, mid-70s, pre-Blake Seven, I think. Has to do with Stonehenge. And he's like a scientist. You know, it's not like terrifying, but
yeah,
there's some creepy stuff in it.
You know what? So, you just brought up a good point, too. There's a brilliant British TV series called Survivors that was created in the early 70s by Terry Nation.
Yes,
and it is about survivors of a plague that the world gets wiped out. And it's worth seeking out not only the original, because the original has lots of downer scenes in it, but the remake series, I think from 2010, 2011, that unfortunately did not continue and was excellent.
I remember
the remake. Yeah. So anyways, you were going to get to Star Wars.
Happened here in the early 80s, and that is that nuclear war is a very real thing. It's going to happen any minute. It's truly paranoia is at a fever pitch because of, Khrushchev and Ronald Reagan, at least, you know, in this country, they're constantly talking about it. I mean, you know, Sting's writing songs about it, you know, we're in a bad place.
Yeah. Things got a little sticky, once Reagan came in, because it became more of a pro-military, feeling again in America.
Yes. And
we were all on board.
We're going to show our might. And also people started to get kind of worried because he was an older fella.
Yeah.
Sometimes people were worried about just, you know, could he wake up in the middle of the night and, you know, hit the wrong button in the White House, you know, looking for a sandwich and next thing you know. So lots of comedy coming out about this, lots of you know, satire. But two things are happening. One, we're getting, again, a slight resurgence of big budget or low budget or – shit, Australian, whatever it is, post-apocalyptic films, mostly action, almost all action-related. And then the other end of the spectrum, very, po-faced kind of, this could really happen tomorrow.
Right, we got like The Day After and Threads, which are
okay,
god-awful.
Remember
I mean, they're good, but...
They're good, but that, let me just say, remember how earlier I was talking about a handful of things that gave me nightmares for a long, long time.
Yeah.
The Day After did nothing for me. The Day After was comical. I mean, The Day After, in this country, you know, in the classroom, they made the teachers talk about it for weeks beforehand.
Yeah,
handed us materials about it. We had to read about it. We had to discuss it. We had to watch it when it was on, write papers about it. And, it, you know, we were supposed to be scared to our core. Well, it didn't. It was Steve Guttenberg.
He scared me.
John Lithgow, who else was in that thing? Marjo Gortner, no, I don't know. Joey Heatherton, loads of people in this thing. But that was this big, big event television on ABC, a two-hour made-for-TV movie. And it didn't do much for me, didn't scare me, whatever. However, about a year later, so that was 83, about a year later in 84, local television is going to run something called Threads, which was, I believe, it might have been theatrical in the UK. Maybe it was made for TV. I don't remember. But I remember the local, you know, head of the local network, the syndicated, you know, network, Channel 9, making a little message before the thing saying, this is incredibly graphic, you know, watch with your families, but parental guidance suggested, And, you know, this was the legend, I think, that I'd heard. I read it in the paper, even as a 13-year-old, that some local stations wouldn't play this thing. I haven't seen it in 30 years, but it scared the socks off me. I mean, it really gave me nightmares because it didn't just give you what would happen. It's probably very dated now, but it was very, very, very graphic. I mean, it followed this one nameless girl, this character. You follow her, and it goes on for like 10, 15 years, what things would sort of look like. And then, you know, when she has a child, and then that child has a child, and people are eating rats, and they no longer know how to speak, and all kinds of horrific, absolutely terrifying. And it made the day after look like, you know, Barney and Friends or something. That was a very, very scary movie, and not a fun movie. But you know, before that, we got some fun stuff.
In England, they made something called The War Game in the 60s that was also terrifying. I have a copy of that. It is another horrifying idea of what nuclear war would be like, and it's scarier than The Day After, and it's about 20 years older.
Have you ever seen The Road?
Yes, of course. The feel-good movie of the year.
It is absolutely brilliant. It is brilliantly done. It is not something you can watch every 5 years. It is so real and so palpable what this environment would be like. By far, even more so than Threads, if anything would scare me about those possibilities, it would be something like The Road. But Threads is really horrific. But let's try to wrap this up soon on happier notes about some of the mental stuff that comes out in the early 80s that would be considered post-apocalyptic.
Yeah,
and Space Hunter, is that a
No, I wouldn't call that post-apocalyptic, but no? What happens is you have these kind of dystopian films coming out of the US that are somewhat futuristic, like The Warriors and Escape from New York, and then they go to Italy and they become post-apocalyptic movies. Like my favorite is After the Fall of New York. Have you seen this, Jason?
Is this this isn't the Vic Morrow one?
No, that would be the Bronx series. I'll get into that.
Okay.
After the Fall of New York is basically Escape from New York, but now it's after nuclear war, and instead of Pliskin, you have Parsifal.
Nice.
And you have to see this movie because it's just weird, and they throw a lot of spaghetti at the wall. That's not racist. It's just.
I was going to say I'm Italian, and I may take offense.
Yeah, I know. they got ape mutants in it. They've got sex mutants. I'm not going to do it any justice. It is weird. It is a weird film. I will put clips on it. I also really like it. You know, it was one of those things that I was walking in a video store with my wife about 15 years ago, and I was like, you know, I always wanted to see this as like a battered VHS copy of it. And she said, me too. And we rented it, and we just thought it was great. Now I own it on DVD.
She's the coolest wife. Like, how does she even know what the hell it was?
Well, because she used to wander video stores. She grew up in a town where they had a lot of video stores, and they had two seasons, winter and July 3rd. You know,
God, I miss VHS covers.
Me too.
You know what's the great? You know what's the the magazine? It's a horror magazine. They're actually very kind to Biff Bang Pow. They put us in there like every month. Damn it! What's Horror Hound?
Could be.
Horror Hound does and has been now for like a year or more has been doing articles on VHS packaging from the late 70s, early 80s, and really good extensive stuff. What's really interesting, I don't know if you knew this, I did not know this, there are a handful of releases, mainly in the horror genre. There's one called House of the Devil, which is a great horror movie. Ty West did it. He did The Innkeepers, House of the Devil, something else that's pretty good. It's a very early 80s feeling horror film, but it's only been the past couple of years. When they released that on home DVD, they did a limited run
on VHS.
Yeah. With like a plastic, you know, case with the wrap.
I hate to tell you this because it makes me feel sad, but people, I have a friend that's 10 years my junior.
Uh-huh.
His parents used to own a comic store and we're still friendly. His name is Kelly Forbes, and he actually releases VHS movies. It's very cool be kind of retro, and it's sort of like, huh, I still have a lot of VHS. Like, that's still, I still pop in tapes, you know? So I don't feel as kind of ironic and cool as those guys because, you know, it's still a format I use.
Oh, that's funny because what they're saying is, you know, it's such a, not only is the format, you know, dead, obviously, but it's the artwork. It's kind of like the whole, you know, vinyl resurgence.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? I kind of applaud it. I think it's really cool. Although I don't really love going to a show and seeing a VHS tape of like Horror Express or something I've seen in every video store and having a 28-year-old go, that's really rare.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's not.
There's also a book. That's right. I saw this at a show like a year ago. There's a book that celebrates that whole genre. Those VHS covers of horror stuff that had very little to do with kind of what was going on, you know, in the actual, you know, content of the film.
Yes.
But it's a great reference book. But anyway,
the other films you just mentioned were the 1990, The Bronx Warriors, and Escape from a Bronx. They're not necessarily, they're a little more, they're sci-fi kind of remakes of the Warriors because they have clown gangs and, you know, different gangs in them. And they all center around, I think, a character called, what's his name? Trash. And Mystery Science Theater picked up the sequel.
If Vic Morrow died on the set of Twilight Zone, which was 82, they shot that thing.
Yeah.
He was in 1990 at Bronx.
Yeah, I think that thing took forever to get here because that came out like in 84.
84, 85.
Here, I think it was like an 81 or 82 film because – and, you know, because they had to replace him with Henry Silva in the sequel.
Oh, they did?
But, you know – they use the word Warriors in the title, and it's definitely, you know, 1990, The Bronx Warriors. It was made in 82. It got here in 83 or 84, but it was already kind of dated.
I was going to make a terrible off-color Vic Morrow post-mortem.
We're not kind to Vic Morrow. Joe. I think a lot of the stuff we talk about is kind of like embarrassing parts of his career. You know, I think
he was great in space. Combat, wasn't he? Rat Patrol or Combat? Which
he
one
was in
it?
Combat.
Combat.
I think.
Great show.
Because I watched
his own movie until he kind of lost his head.
Oh, come too on. Soon.
See? You know who his daughter is, right?
Yeah, Jennifer Jason Leigh.
And you know who he was married to, right?
No.
Nipsey Russell.
Oh, boy, he's coming up a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a big fan of the post-apocalyptic movies, Nipsey.
You know, we forgot two 70s films I wanted to talk about. One, I'm sure you've seen, Damnation Alley.
Oh, yeah. You know what's funny about Damnation Alley? When I used to live in Toluca Lake, people that live in the area will know what I'm talking about. But anyway, you'd have to, when you'd go back into Toluca Lake from Hollywood, you'd take Barham, a street called Barham, over the hill, and then you'd come down and it would spit you out in the media district of Toluca Lake, Burbank, where Warner Brothers is and all that stuff. When you go the opposite direction, when you would go over Barham, it would turn into Cahuenga as you're heading toward the Hollywood Bowl. For years, this is mid-90s, late 90s. For years, when you would take that left where Barham became Cahuenga and headed into Hollywood, on the right side, there was a gas station, and just next to it was like an empty little sort of lot that was connected to this gas station. And there was the big...
The Landmaster.
The Landmaster from...
That's where I was going with this. That's a Dean Jeffries vehicle, and it just sat on a lot for years.
I used to see it every day and just kind of wave to it.
Now, Dean Jeffries was notorious for taking, renting out his vehicles to any production that he wanted them. So, like, the car from Logan's Run, you'd see it in... I saw it in Ice Pirates. It's in a Tom Petty video.
And they used the big... Rover in some other TV show.
The Landmaster, right? The last time I saw it, Chris Elliott was fighting it. It was a paperboy machine on Get a Life. That's the last time I saw the Landmaster. I think it's in a private collection now.
Well,
but it is definitely the best thing about that movie.
Absolutely. And the giant cockroaches, right?
Okay. It's an interesting film. It's a shit film.
Bad film.
Yeah. But I think that came out in 77.
And Jan Michael Vincent, right?
George Peppard. What's that kid's name? I want to say...
James at 17?
No, it's not James at 17. This was the movie that Fox thought was going to be the bigger hit than Star Wars.
Yes, they did.
Earle Haley.
Earle Haley's in it.
Yeah. And basically...
So it's pre-Breaking Away Jackie Earle Haley.
Yeah.
It's pre-Battle Beyond the Stars, George Peppard.
Yeah, his breakthrough role.
His breakthrough role. God bless. You know, George Peppard, people forget, he was a big name in the early 60s. You know, Breakfast at Tiffany's, Romance, the Blue, what was the Blue Angel, the Blue Fox, the Blue Angel, the Blue.
I don't know.
It was like a World War One or World War II thing or something. He was a big, and I don't know when it happened. I don't know if it was booze or what happened to this guy where... He was doing stuff like this, and it wasn't until the A-Team, which he still got made fun of for. I mean, he was on TV. He was Banachek.
I like Banachek.
He was Banachek, for crying out loud. That's right. In the 70s, 60s or 70s was Banachek.
Banachek. I was unemployed in the 70s. I was unemployed for a period in the 90s, and I got to intimately know every Banachek, Columbo. McMillan and wife was like, okay, I got to get a job.
What I loved was all these detective shows. It wasn't like... You know, the Maltese elephant. You know, every one of them was a name of a guy.
Yeah.
You had Banachek, you had Mannix, you had Delvecchio. Wasn't Delvecchio was he a lawyer or a cop?
I don't know Delvecchio.
A man called Sloan. All these names. Hooker. But anyway, so Peppard is in this thing. Jackie Earle Haley. Is Yaphet Kotto in it?
I don't think it's Yaphet Kotto. Is it Yaphet Kotto or is it Paul Winfield?
Paul Winfield.
Yeah.
Now, don't judge me for...
No, I can see how you could get those two mixed up facially.
Right?
Yeah,
They're both
genre stuff. They both kind of have that puffy face, I guess.
They're both Italian.
Yes. Yes.
You know?
I believe Paul Winfield's from Sicily.
Say it again? What'd you say?
I said I believe Paul Winfield's from Sicily.
He was from Sicily, and he's a sissy as well.
Yes.
I thought that's originally what you had said.
He was the mirror on The Charmings.
He was the what?
The mirror on The Charmings.
The Charmings?
Yeah, the ABC sitcom about Prince Charming. And
oh, my God.
I was the only person who watched it, I guess.
I would have completely forgotten about that had you not just brought it up.
I had a crush on Caitlin O'Heaney.
Directed by Jack Smite, by the way. It's horrible. Not a director you're going to have a lot of confidence in if you go on the set the first day. The guy's last name is Smite.
It's a bit of a programmer. Some of the neat things are the visuals. The skies look really neat. But all in all, it's kind of a pointless movie it's based on a Roger Zeleny book. I think they took out what made the book special, to be perfectly honest.
And Jan Michael Vincent, just for the record, still alive.
Yep.
He's actually still alive.
Then I think that movie may have killed the whole genre because it didn't pay off, and then everybody wanted to go in space and be happy. So
yes, but then something happens in the early 80s, and that for me, well, late 70s, really, the biggest thing that came out of this, you know, these loads of shitty movies that get made and TV things and whatever else, the biggest thing I think that came out of this world was Mad Max. Was Max Rockatansky. The first Mad Max to me was post-apocalyptic or whatever, but it didn't necessarily scream post-apocalyptic. Whereas
I think it's society just before it breaks down, personally.
Yes, okay.
That's actually been a debate with friends of mine, whether or not the war has happened. I think it has.
Road Warrior is definitely full on some shit went down.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And actually, I might be getting this wrong. It was called – was it called Mad Max 2 in Australia and then Road Warrior in the U.S. or the other way around? Do you know?
I'd be the wrong guy to ask.
But that was a big freaking movie, and it also was very big – I associate it very much with that time frame of home video, of for me anyway, really discovering, you know, home video or rentals and watching shit over and over and over again. And John Carpenter's The Thing,
yeah,
and again, not related to the episode we're talking about, but The Road Warrior were two of those pictures that we just watched over and over and over and over again, could not get enough of. Both from 82.
You know what? It's funny you say that, but yeah, I would absolutely say that film was one of my favorite. The first Mad Max was one of my favorites as a teenager. It's just such a great revenge film.
Bit of trivia.
Yeah.
For the U.S. release, his voice was dubbed throughout the entire picture.
Yeah, by AIP. Who didn't
That's
know
right.
what they had, and I'm not fan. I'm not a fan of the third one. And
no, it's got a couple of moments.
It's got a real cult following. Like you know, it made an impact. I think on a few people a few years younger. But I saw it at 14, and I thought they had gotten a little too Hollywood with it.
Here's what's interesting. Kind of coming full circle to wrap this up.
Yeah.
We've gotten a bit of a resurgence of the post-apocalyptic thing. We've got Oblivion, the Tom Cruise thing, which kind of addresses that.
We had a remake of the Omega Man, basically, in I Am Legend.
Yeah, I Am Legend, which is the original title of the story.
I was really looking forward to that until I saw it. It's a retooling of the Omega Man.
Yeah, pretty much.
And they took out a lot of it. I think it's very flawed.
Would you say that WALL-E is a post-apocalyptic, not apocalypse necessarily, but we've destroyed the Earth?
Yeah, I could say that, I guess.
And then
you know that you got This Is the End with
Seth Rogen.
Right.
You of course have got The Road, which is horrific.
Super happy, fun, smile hour.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
You know what? I've often said that if I. Like, I had a friend who had a copy of Requiem for a Dream on his shelf.
Oh, man.
I was like, why would you own this?
Yeah, why would you?
And he's like, it's a good movie. And I'm like, no, I'm not debating that.
It's like The Deer Hunter. It's a fantastic film.
Yeah.
But I'm never going to say, you know, hey, it's Saturday night. Hey, let's pop into Deer Hunter. Let's get a pizza. And
yeah.
What do you say we watch The Deer Hunter?
Yeah, and then we all jump off a roof.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
And then to come full circle, this has been mooted for a long, long time. But I think it's finally going to get a release, or at least happening. George Miller is doing a remake of Mad Max.
Oh, yeah.
With Tom Hardy playing Max Rockatansky.
Good cast.
So,
Tom Hardy.
It just goes to show that people never get tired of the apocalypse.
Nope.
You know what I'm saying? Apocalypse
yep.
Now. The only reason we haven't mentioned Apocalypse Now is because
it has nothing to do with the apocalypse.
Nothing to do with the apocalypse.
And those of you who are curious, I would highly recommend a film by Toho, called The Last Days of Planet Earth. Is that what it's called?
Oh, that's kind of rings a bell.
Oh, there's two I just want to briefly mention. One is by Toho. It actually was originally a Nostradamus film that the only way you can get a copy is to find the severely hacked U.S. version because it's only 72 minutes long, because they depicted nuclear war victims as kind of like monsters. And Toho pulled it from distribution in 1980. I think it was on VHS. I'll put a link to it if it's on YouTube. And the other one I just wanted to talk about briefly is Canada made a – and I didn't expect you to see this. Canada made a post-apocalyptic type film called Deadly Harvest, which is about, again, no one being able to grow grain. And it stars Clint Howard and Kim Cattrall. And
maybe I haven't seen this yet.
No, because it's not an easy thing to find. The scene that kills me is that they show a haunting scene of all these closed restaurants.
Okay.
But it's very very clear. They're just driving down Kingston Road in Scarborough, which is not far from where I live, on a Sunday morning.
You know,
so like nothing is abandoned. Like the A&W is really clean. It just doesn't have any cars in the parking lot, and they're playing this kind of like music, and you're like, yeah, everything's closed. It's Sunday morning. You know,
I'm gonna throw something into the mix here real quick, and we gotta wrap this up. But you've thrown out like six little seen or never seen films people can try to hunt down. There's a great film. I haven't seen it in many, many years, but I remember it being very good, called Miracle Mile. Have you ever seen this movie?
Yeah, that's now that's it's not the world's not going to end. They have to get out before a nuclear bomb.
Anthony Edwards and Mayor Winningham. And the gist, in a nutshell, I can even read it from IMDb here. A young man hears a chance phone call telling him that a nuclear war has started and missiles will hit the city in 70 minutes. And take it from there. It's a sleeper kind of film. Anthony Edwards is, I think, a very underrated.
It was very critically acclaimed at the time. I remember that.
Yeah, it's a fun thing.
I am right. Denise Crosby's in it as well.
I'm going to throw one other thing in the mix here and see if this qualifies for our, under the umbrella of what we're discussing. Buck Rogers in the 25th Century. Is that post-apocalypse?
Yeah, I guess it kind of is. The new Chicago scenes.
Right? I mean, there were mutants in there.
We have talked Buck to death, I think. But have we, though? Well, maybe not.
Can you ever talk about it? I mean, we haven't done our space vampire episode yet.
Well, that's Halloween.
Where we only talk about space vampires. Yeah.
We only talk about that particular space vampire and what's that movie that I should know? The Toby Hooper. Life Force.
Caligula. Life Force.
We should just do a Life Force episode.
And I'm just going to say, for the record, I was a little skeptical about this subject and this episode. I'm not going to lie. But, man, if this is proof that we can talk about anything for 90 minutes, it's the fact that we just did a post-apocalypse episode. We're really only talking about movies and TV. This is the first one we haven't talked about, you know, toys and all kinds of other
comic
stuff,
books,
too.
Yeah. And you know what? Next month, we'll do the phone book.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't mean it was enjoyable, but we did it. That's the point. We didn't take a breath.
We did it, damn it.
There you go. Hope you learned something. And, you know, hey, kiss your kids before you go to bed at night, because you never know what kind of phone call you get in the morning, right?
Right.
Apocalyptic.
Until next month, duck and cover, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.